This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello there, and welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, we're very happy to have you on the show, Brent. For one of the most critical areas in the world that we have to watch regarding biblical prophecy, it is Europe. The Bible is clear that a mighty European empire is coming that will dominate the world for a short time. Now, when you look at just how divided Europe is today, and you see how timid and anemic it is in many ways, you know there are going to have to be some serious disruptions before it will have the potency to fulfill those prophecies. And yet the conditions for exactly those kinds of disruptions are becoming clearer and more relevant all the time. This week, our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, recorded a Key of David program, it will air next weekend, about how Europe is already changing dramatically in response to the coronavirus, and this could set it up for even more dramatic changes. This may be one of the most important effects to emerge from this global crisis we're experiencing right now. To talk about how events this week illustrate this point, we're going to go to our man in Britain, Richard.
Yes, you're really seeing how this coronavirus could build to exactly the kind of transformational crisis that we've been watching for in Europe. And over the last week or two, we've seen a lot of tension growing in Europe and how to deal with this crisis. We've talked about the problem with Italy before on this show, and that the countries that are being hit hardest by coronavirus, like Italy and Spain, are the ones in the worst financial positions. So, you know, Italy, the numbers are going up all the time, but last I look, I think they're over 10,000 dead. You've got I think it's nearly 14,000 dead in Italy, and you've got this country then that's being hit hard, but at the same time, they're one of the most indebted economies in the world. Their economy, the level of debt in their economy is already deep into what is regarded as the danger zone by economists, barely able to kind of stay solvent and not go bankrupt. And in the United States and in Britain, we've seen this response where governments have come out with massive spending programs to try and help with the economic effects of the crisis. Italy hasn't been able to do that. They can't borrow money in the same kind of sums that America and Britain are able to borrow money at the moment, and Germany and a lot of European countries, because they've got this massive debt problem. And this has led to now this clash going on that was really been playing out over the last week or so within Europe. You've got Italy saying basically, hey, Germany, can we borrow your credit card for a bit? We promise to pay you back. But we just need to be able to borrow a bit more money. You can borrow at a lower interest rate than we can. So can you help us? Can you help us out here? Germany's been responding by saying, well, no, you've been complete. And not just Germany, the Netherlands as well, and a few others. You guys have a long track record of irresponsible debt. We've worked pretty hard to save and to be in a position that we can borrow money in a crisis like this because we've been paying our debt back. Whereas, you know, you have not been focusing on your economy. You've been having generous benefits. You've been wasteful with your government spending. You have lower pension ages than we do or have had in the past. So if we're going to borrow money for you, we want a whole bunch of conditions in place. And this discussion has been going on with all of these different technical terms, ESM versus corona bonds. But that's the foundation. Germany wants to impose a whole bunch of conditions on Italy before they're allowed to borrow money. Italy looks at that and says, hey, you're trying to use the coronavirus as an excuse to turn us into a colony the way that you did to Greece and Cyprus.
Yeah.
That is, we cannot stand for that. We're not going to let you take over our country as a result of coronavirus. And I think that's a reasonable position for Italians to feel. At the same time, Germans are saying, well, we're not going to give you free access to our credit card without making sure that you're going to be a bit more mature about how you use it and that we're actually going to get that money back and you're not going to end up damaging our credit rating. And I think it's easy to sympathize with that as well. But that fight has really been the dominant theme of what's been going on in European news and politics really over the last couple of weeks.
This is really prompting some observers, and some of them quite prominent observers, to say European Union is at a crisis moment right now, and this could actually pose a danger to its ongoing existence.
Absolutely. And this is just one from this morning, I think from today, European leaders warned coronavirus could lead to the breakup of their union. And I've been seeing headlines like that just about every single day now because of the way that this is playing out. And we have an article in the upcoming Trumpet print that explains, well, that's not ultimately what is going to happen. And I think this is where the subject gets really fascinating. You look at what the Bible says, and then you look at what Mr. Armstrong and Herbert W. Armstrong and Mr. Flowey have been saying based on those Bible prophecies. They've been forecasting a crisis very explicitly. You know, they've been saying that, you know, you look at the Europe of the Bible, there are some massive changes that are coming. And there are some changes coming that people will not want to make. Mr. Armstrong talked about this, that the Bible talks about a 10-nation superpower governed by one man. And he talked about, well, you know, you look at these different arguing nations of Europe. The French don't want to be led by a German. The Italians don't want to be led by someone, you know, who's not Italian. It's going to get them to agree to be led to it by a German strongman. Well, that's going to take a crisis. It's also going to take the involvement of religion and the Catholic Church. But secular Europe right now doesn't want that to happen. And so Mr. Flurry had an article where he, again, very explicitly said, well, it will take a crisis before Europe's going to let the Catholic Church involved. The Bible talks about a 10-nation Europe. Right now we see 27 nations. Mm-hmm. And again, Mr. Flurry said, well, talked about how, based on those prophecies, it's going to take a crisis. He even said people during those crises are going to say the EU is finished. It's over. It's going to fall apart. And he said, you know, don't listen to them. So we've been expecting this kind of a crisis from Europe. And I think you can already see steps where this crisis is pushing Europe to take steps towards a super state. So also just this week, Europe agreed to make a new fund, a new kind of unemployment fund, pooled unemployment fund for the whole Eurozone. And it's not directly the European Union paying people's unemployment benefits. But the idea is it's a 100 million or 100 billion fund, so that if Italy gets into trouble and can't pay or has trouble paying all of its unemployment benefits because you've got a lot of people suddenly unemployed, that the European Union can step in and help with that. We also saw earlier in the crisis the European Central Bank take steps to act much more like a national central bank, like in the Fed or the Bank of England, printing money and buying Italian bonds, something that had been verboten by the Germans before now. So you're seeing Europe take some steps already towards unity, and we've been forecasting a crisis. And I think you can see exactly how this is going to play, or you can see in the general direction, I should say, not necessarily exactly, but the general direction of how this is going to play out. And that, like you mentioned, with that Key of David that I'm very looking forward to watching for Mr. Flurry, you know, this is one of the most important things to watch to come out of the coronavirus and everything that's going on there, is this forcing Europe into this kind of crisis that makes them make those changes that they need to make themselves economically sustainable, to allow them to deal with national crises that they just can't at the moment. And it's going to force them to take those steps.
You know, you mentioned Herbert W. Armstrong and Gerald Flurry talking about how important a crisis would be in order to forge this union together. And I find it interesting. We've drawn attention to a lot of these statements several times over the years, specifically because of those forecasts from Herbert Armstrong, that some of the founders of the EU talked about the same kind of a reality, and the fact that it would take crisis to bring everyone together. We've talked about the fact that even the way that they set up their currency, the way they set up their economic structures, that in some ways it was actually made to create crises. Now, something like the coronavirus that has come along adds a whole dimension to that, and it puts the stresses on those economic structures. It tests them to their limit and beyond. But it's not just Herbert Armstrong. It's not just looking at Bible prophecy. You actually have people who are the architects of this entire project who recognized this even from the very beginning.
Yes, that's a really important point. I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah, Jean Monnet, kind of one of the real founders of the European Union, he said Europe will be forged in crisis and it will be the sum of the solutions adopted for those crises. Mm. These leaders saw, okay, the different people of Europe are not going to want to come together as in a superstate, but we want a superstate. How do we do this? We set up structures that we kind of take them to this halfway point, and then we know that we can rely on crises to put it the rest of the way. This is exactly the same way that the different German states in the late 19th century came together towards Germany. You kind of had this economic union, and then a series of crises pushed them to come together in the state that we now know as Germany. So they've seen this work in the past. And then you see every time a crisis hits, a European leader comes out and makes these kind of statements, like, we need to take advantage of this crisis. Mm-hmm. The last financial crisis, Wolfgang Schäuble, he said, crisis represents an opportunity. Europe has always moved forwards in times of crisis. Sometimes you need a little pressure for certain decisions to be taken. This time around, the governor of Austria's central bank, Robert Holzmann, he said, every economic crisis is a cleansing. One can exploit it to emerge stronger. So yeah, that's the way that Europe is thinking. And not every commentator is out there saying Europe is going to be destroyed. There are some, I think, especially the ones that have a really strong grounding in history, that do see that there is something deeper going on here. The Spectator had a really good article a week or two ago, again, from a historian, talking. He was going all the way back to the Ottoman invasion of into Europe and heading towards Vienna, and about how Europe kind of banded together to meet that response. And he was making the point that there is this historical precedence for Europe coming together to meet these kind of crises, especially in that case, like a religious crisis from a foreign invasion. So there is this overall picture, there's this history, there's these statements, and it all matches exactly with Bible prophecy. So you can see this leading to a very different Europe emerging very quickly from these kind of events.
You know, another thought that strikes me is just when you listen to what Stephen Fleury has been talking about, and you wrote about this in a Trumpet Brief earlier this week about how much you are seeing some European leaders take advantage of this crisis in exactly the way that some of those founders were saying, that they have taken more power to themselves. And you see people actually willingly ceding their freedoms into the hands of these dictators in order to address some of these things in a robust enough fashion. You see the direction toward exactly the kind of strongman politics that the Bible prophesies about. It's another angle that is quite extraordinary. I'm sure that that's going to be addressed in that Key of David program as well. But if you haven't been listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show this week, definitely do so, and also check out Richard's Trumpet Brief from earlier the week on that point of the story. Thank you very much for that, Richard. This difficult circumstance that Italy finds itself in is forcing it to look for allies from wherever it can find them. And it is receiving help from a rather interesting source, that is China. To learn about the prophetic ramifications of this element of the story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, Italy's health system, you know, as we just heard from Richard there, is under a great deal of strain from this outbreak. And China is really coming to the rescue. It was on March 12th that the Chinese government sent its first shipment to Rome. That was 31 metric tons of all kinds of different medical supplies, respirators, masks, ICU equipment, test kits, even plasma from the blood of Chinese people who had recovered from the illness, which apparently helps those who are battling it recover more quickly. And along with this shipment, they also sent 9 Chinese medical experts just to help the Italians understand how to best put it all to use and to kind of share the expertise that they had gained from fighting against this outbreak in China. And one interesting aspect of this is that Italy had first asked its partners in the EU for help with the outbreak. So it was one small part of the battle within the EU that Richard was just talking about there. So Italy had filed a request through the EU's civil protection mechanism requesting help. But none of the EU nations were willing to help. Germany and France initially even went so far as to ban the export of masks to Italy or any other country just because they wanted to ensure that their own populations had enough of those things. So Italy was feeling isolated and desperate, and the crisis just kept intensifying. And that's when China came in with this massive shipment of supplies to Rome. So the Italians were, you know, very grateful for this. And then the Chinese followed that up about a week later with a second shipment to Milan. And then since then, several Chinese companies have made additional smaller donated shipments to various other Italian cities. So it really has been a significant amount of assistance that China has given to the Italians during this time of just such serious difficulty.
Now, you would like to think that this is entirely altruistic on China's part, but it seems like they actually have a pretty strong track record of helping other nations with infrastructure and similar types of things that just viewed on the surface you might think were just humanitarian. But there aren't maybe enough people thinking about the costs that might come with this kind of assistance.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, this is largely a PR move for China. They're trying to regain some of the clout that they lost by unleashing the whole corona epidemic onto the world. But also, as you said, there's a steep cost of doing business with China. And we've seen that play out time and again with the Belt and Road Initiative. That could be viewed really as the signature project of Chinese President Xi Jinping. He's been working for more than 5 years now to convince nations across Asia, the Middle East, Europe, and even Africa, even Latin America to an extent, to work with China to build all kinds of roads and railways and ports and bridges and everything else to better connect the world to China. So it's basically all designed to reshape the international system in a way that puts China at its center. And last March, Italy signed a milestone agreement with China to join it. So it was probably China's biggest victory for the Belt and Road Initiative, not just because it meant that Chinese ships would have access to some of the Mediterranean's choicest ports off the Italian coast, but also because Italy is a G7 country. You know, it's a major economy. The G7 is a group of democratically governed, advanced economies. The other ones are Canada, France, Germany, Japan, the U.S., and the U.K. So these are powerful nations that really shape global policy. So having one of those on board, the BRI, was just a huge victory for China. And now I think China's kind of stepping in to repay that favor. Italy helped them last March by signing on to it, and now China's, you know, helping Italy once again.
Strengthening ties between China and Europe really is something that we have been watching for, and we've been seeing this develop over a period of years now. As these ties are intensifying, it is fulfilling a specific prophecy.
It is, yes. Isaiah chapter 23 discusses a huge trade bloc that will be formed in the modern day. It's called a Mart of Nations, and one of the powers leading that bloc will be a country that Isaiah refers to in verses 1 and 12 as Chittim. And so that's an ancient name for modern-day China. And then also in a lead role will be Tyre. So that's a city that really represents the commercial heart of modern Europe. So that would include Italy in a general way. But then in verse 13, Isaiah also mentions the land of the Chaldeans. So that's a specific designation for the Italians, just saying that they'll be a key part of this modern Mart of Nations. So these scriptures, Isaiah 23, also there's a companion chapter in Ezekiel 27, and it shows that these powers, along with some others, Japan and Russia, they'll eventually come to control global commerce for a short time, and that will be to the detriment of America and some of its allies. These nations, the Asians and the Europeans, will end up blocking the U.S. and the U.K. and Israel out of world trade. Eventually, they'll even orchestrate a massive besiegement of those countries.
Jeremiah has an article about this subject specifically, China, Italy, and coronavirus, laying the foundation for the Mart of Nations. It's a prophecy that you really need to study into, and we can watch this being fulfilled in its infancy even today quite strongly, and the coronavirus is certainly accelerating that. We'll also put a link in our show notes to Gerald Fleury's booklet, Isaiah's End Time Vision, that gives the greater context for that prophecy Jeremiah was describing in Isaiah 23. Thank you very much, Jeremiah. A story from the Middle East now. We've been talking about America starting its drawdown from Afghanistan, handing things over to the Taliban there. America is also pulling out of Iraq. For this story, we'll turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Yes, if you wanted a break from all the corona news on President Trump's Twitter feed, you actually got that partway through this week when he tweeted something about Iran and its and what's happening in Iraq. He said this: Iran or its proxies are planning a sneak attack on U.S. troops and/or assets in Iraq. If this happens, Iran will pay a very heavy price indeed. So that was from the president, and he's referring to actions that Iran may take in Iraq, similar to actions that we saw previously against U.S. bases. There's a number of U.S. bases inside Iraqi territory, and they are there and have been invited there by the Iraqi government. Now, what we've seen over the past couple of weeks is a drawdown of U.S. forces in certain Iraqi bases. Over the past 3 weeks, they've left three bases entirely, one's towards the western part of the country, and they've consolidated their forces around Baghdad and then also up in the Kurdistan region in the north. And this is pretty interesting, is because it comes after there were a number of attacks on American bases by Iraqi Shiite forces that answer to Iran, different proxies that Iran works with inside Iraq, firing on U.S. bases and killing American servicemen. I'm not just talking about the one that precipitated the attack against Soleimani back in late December. There was also one 2 weeks ago that killed two Americans. And so that from that base and the one where the American contractor was killed back in December 28th, those bases are being evacuated and American forces are being consolidated in the north and around Baghdad. And also in the north, you have the deployment of Patriot anti-missile batteries that are being deployed there to stop or to prevent these missile barrages that are coming in. There's been over 30 attacks, separate attacks on U.S. bases in Iraq in the past 6 months. And so the U.S. forces cannot stop these attacks. And so now they're bringing all their forces to a couple of bases and then guarding them with Patriot missile batteries. So while the U.S. right now, you could say they are not pulling all their forces out of Iraq, they are certainly decreasing their footprint inside Iraq and making it more difficult to control the Iraqi territory, all for the sake of preserving its troops, because now they can be under the umbrella of the Patriot missile battery. And one other also interesting thing is Mr. Trump's tweet this week was also coincided with the first visit of Soleimani's replacement over the IRGC. He made his first trip, Kaani is his name, he made his first trip to Baghdad the same day that the president tweeted out that. And so that's probably related to his tweet saying that, well, we've got the IRGC guy now in Baghdad and we have the increase of attacks on our forces. Maybe they are trying to plot something and we are going to consolidate our forces into these bases to protect ourselves.
Now, Brent, we've talked about just how Donald Trump had this red line of American deaths. There were a lot of provocations by Iran against the United States, but then as soon as you had American deaths, that was apparently what provoked the strike against Qasem Soleimani. Here it seems the United States is reacting differently with more of a retreat. Is it that simple, what we're seeing here? Is this a change? Is this a reflection of the U.S. being more focused on response to coronavirus or, you know, preoccupied in other areas? What do you account for the change?
There's probably a couple of things. I would say that the U.S. sees Iran's position right now as weakening. Corona is taking is hitting Iran more than it has any other nation in the Middle East. And so they might decide that for the time being, we don't want to strike against, let's say, Iran and make ourselves an essential player here if Iran is already going downhill. And so let's just let that play out for the time being. But you're right, there's been two deaths of American servicemen after that red line was given by President Trump, and nothing has happened. So I think we can talk. There are other things going on with this for sure. I think the United States is just trying to recalibrate its entire position in the Middle East, and especially in Iraq. It cannot protect all of its forces from every Shiite militia that wants to lob a couple of Katyusha rockets, which are highly infantile in their accuracy. You just fire them, they hope they land there. These are what these forces, these Shiite militias, have been firing at U.S. bases. And so do they go after every single one of these that most of them look like they have? Well, they definitely all have links to Iran. Whether they're getting the actual orders from Iran is another question. Does the U.S. come down hard on these militias and basically chase around a bunch of the pawns of Iran? Or does it decide to go after Iran proper? I think President Trump has understood that we're facing a losing war if we don't target Iran. But right now, it looks like Iran is going to fall by the wayside by itself, or at least let's see if that plays out, and then we'll decide how to act. And so for the time being, consolidate on a few bases, protect them with the Patriot missile batteries, and then we'll see what happens. We know from Bible prophecy that Iran is not going to go by the wayside because of Corona or its, you know, the high pressure campaign or the sanctions against it. It is going to stay there. It is going to stay, in line, or it's not going to change its outlook in terms of how it's pushing the world towards war. It still wants to do that. Maybe Iran is trying to bait America into some action to get in Iraq to perhaps get the attention off itself or maybe distract its own people from how they've handled the coronavirus. But Bible prophecy says Iran is not going away because of this American position. But Bible prophecy does indicate that America is going to be backing out of the Middle East, and particularly in Iraq. As we've written before, every major biblical prophecy in the Middle East takes place in the vacuum created by the United States exit. It does not feature in biblical prophecy in terms of end time prophecies in the Middle East. The United States doesn't. And so it is going to retreat. And as it consolidates forces into a couple of these bases, it might be easier for the president to just say at the end, you know, what are we even doing there? Let's just pull our troops home. And so it is all building towards that. And that's what Bible prophecy says.
If people wanted more information, where would you send them?
Warren Reinsch is actually writing an article on this right now. And so it should be up shortly. It's entitled America Signals Retreat in Iraq.
Well, we will look forward to that article, and thank you very much for that, Brent. Now to the United States. The lockdown over coronavirus concerns is getting stricter and stricter. More cities and states are locking down all the time, and amid concerns that these measures violate Americans' constitutionally guaranteed freedoms, the government is taking stronger steps to enforce these quarantine measures. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, as the coronavirus spreads, all the governors in all 50 states have called up members of the National Reserve to help fight the epidemic, mainly distributing food, running screening facilities, disinfecting public places, things like that. But the governors of at least 22 states have approved the use of what they call dual status commanders to oversee these operations. These are commanders who report to the governor on the one hand, but then also report to Lieutenant General Laura Richardson over at NORTHCOM in the U.S. military, which raises some concerning implications because in the first case, some states, not all states, but some states have already started using National Guard personnel to enforce lockdowns. I think Rhode Island's even sent people door-to-door, National Guard soldiers door-to-door to make sure you stay in your homes. So that's pretty clearly a violation of Americans' First Amendment rights to peaceably assemble, a violation of even trial by jury. You're putting people who haven't committed a crime and may not be sick under house arrest without any sort of trial or due process of law. And that's on the state level. But these dual-use commanders bring the U.S. military into all this. And the Secretary of Defense this week even announced that the federal government's giving their full approval to the state governors using National Guard troops to enforce lockdowns. And so this kind of raises the specter of the federalization of local law, or even martial law, where the military starts suspending civil rights in the names of security.
So we talked about this trend under the Obama administration quite a lot. The fact that there were many federal entities that were gaining power and even like police type powers, and there was a certain effort by the Obama administration to empower these federal agencies in that way. And that does seem consistent with the general move among the left in American politics, that they like that centralization of power. What do you make of the fact that this is happening under the Trump administration?
Right, and that is interesting. And the Trump administration, from anything I've seen, is definitely not the driving force behind this. Probably the worst you could be said is they've been just very apathetic and nonchalant and letting it happen. Because right now it is mostly state governors that are using the National Guard to enforce the lockdowns. And then the Trump administration has given the military permission to use these dual status commanders and said that they're fine with the state governors using the National Guard in this way. But even that, I think, may be the most concerning trend on the Trump administration's part is how much power's being delegated to like deep state officials or military officials. It kind of something clicked. Well, just a thought came to my mind is I wrote an article, seems like a long time ago, like 6 years ago, about a directive the Obama administration made that didn't make a ton of sense to me at the time. But the Insurrection Act of 1807 very explicitly forbids the militarization of law enforcement. The military cannot intervene in domestic law enforcement, except in one case, if martial law is declared. And martial law, to declare it, it takes an act of Congress, the proverbial act of Congress, and presidential authorization on top of that. And Congress and the president can only do that in the event of a foreign invasion or a civil war, a domestic rebellion. Now, the Obama administration kind of unilaterally and quietly issued a directive to the Defense Department that they're saying, like, well, they said if there was an insurrection or a rebellion and the president couldn't be reached, then the unelected generals or field commanders on the ground could intervene if they needed to. And that's pretty vague because the Constitution definitely was very explicit. They said in this one extreme circumstance, the one person in the nation that everyone gets to vote for can make that call as to whether you need the military to put down a rebellion. But then just passing this law, like, well, it's like if you if you call the president and he doesn't pick up and someone's rebelling, you could enforce martial law on your own if you want to, if you really wanted to. And so at the time I was like, why would Obama delegate that power out of his own hands? Unless he's a foresighted enough to know that, well, maybe I won't be president forever. If someone I don't like is president, and I have, you've got these deep state officials that really don't like President Trump. I mean, you've got structures in place to do some pretty authoritarian things. And I don't know if there's more time. There's a lot I could say about internal divisions in the military or in the event of a civil war, which branches of the military will pick which side. Bit of a speculation there as well. But I think for the prophetic angle here, one of the main things I like to focus on is just the article our editor-in-chief wrote on America's Been Fundamentally Transformed, where he points to this prophecy in 2 Kings 14, verses 26 and 27, where it says God raising up an end-time leader, Jeroboam or Donald Trump, as he identifies in that article, to temporarily save Israel. And for those who haven't been paying close attention to the ins and outs of what's going on in the government, this idea that Trump saved America from being destroyed could seem a little melodramatic. It's like, well, you know, like President Obama, he passed a bad healthcare plan. he was rude to some of our allies, but he's out of office now, and it's kind of all blown past. But then the more revelations you see like this, especially like the NSA spying, the ability to spy on every American, what the FBI and the CIA was doing to spy on the Trump campaign, frame him for a Russia collusion crime he didn't commit, and rig an election. And now even some of these changes in the Defense Department where they're like, well, if the flu gets really bad, the only reason we haven't imposed martial law already is because President Trump doesn't want to. If Joe Biden's already gone on the record saying that if he was president, he would have called out the troops long before now.
Hmm.
It does show that there was a what they call a turnkey authoritarian state in place. That's an authoritarian state you build in secret while everyone goes about their business, and then one day you turn the key, all the pieces snap together. You're trapped in George Orwell's 1984, and there's nothing you can do about it. That America was well on that path until President Trump's was elected. And President Trump hasn't actually dismantled that turnkey authoritarian state. Mm. He's just not turning the key, which we can all be very thankful for. But at some point, you need to start dismantling those structures so no future president can turn the key.
Mm.
And that's something that, well, when you don't realize that your freedoms come from God, that's something that Americans don't seem to be putting nearly as high priority on doing as you'd think they would.
Right. Yeah. There are so many of and Richard has been bringing this out. Stephen Fleury has been bringing this out on his program, just how quickly those freedoms can be stripped from us because of a lack of vigilance and a lack of appreciation and love for those freedoms that we have had. America has been fundamentally transformed is the name of the article by Gerald Fleury that really shows how dangerous this trend is. Even though we are living in the days of President Trump, so many of those trends are still unfolding below the surface. We thank you very much for that. Andrew, you're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, an update on Israel forming a unity government and the constitutional issues that nation is having to confront in the process. We'll also talk about more coronavirus effects, how it's drawing China and India together, and also causing grocery prices in America to soar. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
As we spoke about last Friday, the stalemate in Israeli politics was broken last week when the opposition party to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu agreed to form a unity government. For an update on developments this week, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
So they did agree to form a unity government, but they're still hashing out the details, and that's going to probably continue in up till sunset today between Benny Gantz and of Blue and White and also Prime Minister Netanyahu of Likud. Now, this is still going on for a number of reasons. There's mainly two issues that they're facing about whether they can form a unity government or come together in a coalition. The first one is regarding Gantz's position on the peace plan and President Trump's peace plan. Gantz had said prior to the election to Donald, to Mr. Donald Trump, and also to the public, that he would implement the peace plan of Mr. Donald Trump. And Netanyahu is wondering right now whether he will go ahead and do that, or whether he will torpedo his government's efforts to start the peace plan off, because he'll be part of the Yundi government and he wouldn't have the support of the majority of the Knesset if Gantz isn't for it. And so they're cashing out details on that point to ensure that Gantz will go ahead with the peace plan, at least the initial stages of the peace plan, which would declare Israeli sovereignty over much of the West Bank, including the Jordan Valley. So that's point number one. The second point of contention is that of government portfolios. Who's going to get which ministries? And the ministries that are of most concern to Benjamin Netanyahu are the ministries that revolve around law enforcement, justice ministry, and also the public services ministry, or public security ministry. The public security ministry is the one that is the ministry that decides upon who the police chief is going to be. And since the police are notoriously anti-Netanyahu and have actually targeted him and his associates in investigations, he wants to make sure that stops. And so he wants to have his guy, Likud, running that ministry. And then you'll have the justice ministry as well. Blue and white looks like they're going to get the justice ministry. And the justice ministry has the right to elect or choose who the state prosecutor is going to be. And since Netanyahu is under indictment, and in the next 6 months that case is going to be brought towards the Supreme Court, he wants to make sure that the state prosecutor isn't in bed with the left, isn't in bed with the Israeli deep state, to ensure that he gets a fair trial. And so, yes, they're fundamentally agreed that they are going to come together, but who has control over these portfolios is something that they're working out right now.
So it seems Netanyahu is concerned about the impartiality of the judiciary. How real are those concerns?
I think the events that surrounded last week and the folding up of Benny Gantz, it shows just how sour the judiciary is towards, especially the Supreme Court, to Mr. Netanyahu. You'll remember that at the time last week, the reason that this folded up is because Blue and White wanted to, Benny Gantz's party wanted to come together with the Joint Arab List to run a bill through the parliament that would essentially negate the election and not allow Prime Minister Netanyahu from becoming Prime Minister again. And the Speaker of the House didn't want to bring that vote to the House, and so he resigned. Well, the Supreme Court stepped in and then said, well, what you've done is bad. You shouldn't have resigned. In fact, we are going to then institute, the Supreme Court did, we are going to tell you who the Speaker is going to be. It's going to be this guy, and he is a member of the Knesset, and he is going to have the opportunity now to run this parliamentary vote, which was an absolute intervention by the Supreme Court into the legislature, which is unparalleled really in Israel's history, that they would declare who the Speaker is going to be and tell the Speaker, you must vote on this, when there was no law that said that the judiciary could do that. And so, yes, Prime Minister Netanyahu has rights to be worried that his case is not going to receive fair treatment. And, you know, this is what Israel faces right now, this war that is upcoming between Netanyahu's government and the judiciary. This is not going to go away. And this is something that is going to increase in the near future because of his indictment and also because of the nation state bill that's going to come up towards the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court for the past 20 years, basically since the early 90s, has been adjudicating cases that it had no right to adjudicate, basically striking down Knesset laws, saying that they are illegal based on its own interpretation of several laws that were changed in Israel's history. But the nation of Israel, the population, sees what's going on, and half the population is extremely worried about the powers that the judiciary is taking over the elected government, and half of the country wants the judiciary to take those powers because it means that Netanyahu will be removed from office. And so this is not going to go away. I think last Thursday was an amazing moment where Netanyahu came out of nowhere to have a Yundi government and stay in power. Carolyn Glick's comment just this week in her, or just today in her article, she said that last week Israel almost lost it all. If this vote was going to go ahead, where, you know, the joint list was going to come together with Benny Gantz to then negate Netanyahu, Israel had lost it all, and it was going downhill. But there, in a surprise moment, really, Netanyahu maintained power. The problems aren't going to go away, but there is a battle on right now for the fight for the survival of the state of Israel. And Carrigan Glick sees it. A few others see it. Certainly our editor-in-chief sees it, Mr. Gerald Flurry. He's watching what's going on in Israel with a keen eye, particularly related to this deep state that does exist. Front page Haaretz right now is an article about how Netanyahu claims is a deep state and it's controlling Israel. And they laugh about it. But the very last line of that article says this, and for our listeners, it'll be surprising. It says this is from Haaretz, a left-leaning newspaper. It says this: when the prime minister is convinced that he's being conspired against by demonic figures battling him for control of the country, he can justify to himself and others any action to protect himself. If only this Haaretz writer knew what he just wrote, that there is actually a demonic power that is trying to take down the state of Israel. And yes, Netanyahu is standing up against those forces, just like we have those demonic powers that are trying to take down the United States, to blot out the United States. Those same forces are at play here. And for the time being, it seems like Netanyahu is receiving enough power to counteract them. If people want to read more about this biblical backing to this takeover that's taking place and those demonic powers, they need to read an article that was written, or a blog post that was written by the managing editor of thetrumpet.com, Mr. Brad McDonald. It's entitled "The Prophecy That Explains the World."
Excellent. Thank you very much for that, Brent. We'll put a link to that in the show notes for today's program. We appreciate that report. Brent, we spoke in the first half about how the coronavirus would accelerate the formation of a European empire. Well, it certainly seems to be accelerating the coalescing of another power prophesied in this end time, this one in Asia. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, this is an interesting situation because China is, of course, the undisputed originator of the Wuhan coronavirus, or COVID-19. And as we discussed on the program last week, it was really the Chinese Communist Party's dishonesty and its ineptitude that unleashed this thing on the world. You know, the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, was focused only on serving itself. And so there's so much more that they could have done early on to prevent the spread, but instead they behaved the way dictators do, Xi Jinping and the rest of the party. And now the world is reeling, and China's neighbor, India, is under the harshest and most extensive lockdown in the world, harsher than the one in Italy, even harsher than the one that China had. And you might expect the Indian government to be turning on China a little bit, or at least ascribing well-deserved blame to Beijing. But instead, India is intentionally refraining from pointing the finger at China. And the two seem to be actually drawing closer together during this pandemic. On Wednesday, Xi Jinping talked about how China and India now face this unprecedented level of opportunity to elevate their ties amidst this pandemic. And the Chinese foreign ministry said that China is eager to help India do all it can to contain the virus. And then on the Indian side, you had very similar rhetoric this week. Prime Minister Narendra Modi really praised the Sino-Indian relationship this week, and he talked about how they need to work together now more than ever. And India's external affairs minister published a statement about how the two are gearing up to fight together against the coronavirus. So it's really notable that not only is the Indian government not blaming China for this civilization-altering, economy-destroying event, but it's working closely with China to contain it. And it's really putting those cooperation efforts on display for the whole world to see.
Which is quite prophetically relevant.
Yes, it is. You know, it's possible that as the costs of this illness and the national lockdown set in across India, maybe the people and the government will begin to ascribe more blame to China. But whatever may happen in the near term, Bible prophecy shows that eventually India will almost certainly join a multinational conglomerate of Asian nations that Bible prophecy says will come together in the end time. The book of Revelation calls this the kings of the East, It says it'll have 200 million soldiers. And then the book of Ezekiel says it'll be led by Russia, with China in kind of a junior position of leadership. Ezekiel also lists some ancient names for modern-day India, showing that India will be a part of this bloc as well. So what we see happening right now with India working together with China and refraining from even blaming it for this pandemic, I think you could see that for sure as setting the stage for those prophecies to be fulfilled.
Well, Jeremiah explains this in more depth in an article that he has up on the website at thetrumpet.com, China and India, Camaraderie in the Time of Corona. We'll link to that in the show notes, as well as our booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy, that shows just how the entire Asian continent is prophesied to come together, as we're seeing take place between China and India today. Thanks for that, Jeremiah. Back now to Italy, where the problems associated with coronavirus are creating some serious social problems. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yeah, this helps illustrate how big of a crisis this could be for Europe, economically, politically, but also just how it can affect the whole social fabric and lead to some major political changes in Europe. So in southern Italy, especially, people are starting to reach a bit of a dangerous situation. They're running out of money. They're not getting much aid from the government. One of Italy's problems is a lot of people are working on the black market, and so they're not paying their taxes and things like that. That's caused their economic problems. But now that that black market money has dried up, it's much harder for them to go and get help from the government as well. So you're starting to get people making videos talking about how they're not able to feed their kids anymore and how they're starving. There are people coming together online trying to form gangs to go and rob supermarkets, because they're saying, well, we've just run out of cash. This is our only option. You've got the mafia as kind of being one of the few organized organizations. Sorry for that double use of words. But anyway, one of the few organizations that has money right now in southern Italy. People are afraid that this is going to be a major recruiting opportunity for them. So you get a glimpse of how this kind of a crisis can lead to a social breakdown. It's been on a relatively low level, but you certainly see the anger building, and you get the feeling that things in southern Italy are starting, are simmering, are getting ready to boil. So it's a situation to watch, and it's a situation that we, I think we can see quite clearly how something like this could spread to Britain, to America, if our governments reach the same situation where they're unable to borrow money and hand it out to people to kind of help get them through the hard times that they don't have savings for to get through themselves.
Well, thanks for that, Richard. And that we'll just transition right into our last story about similar effects taking place in the United States. For this, we'll go to Andrew.
Yeah, one effect of the corona epidemic that most of our listeners have probably already noticed is that food prices, grocery prices are increasing dramatically. The prices of wheat and flour have gone up 15% on average. Rice prices have gone up 20%. Orange juice, 20% more expensive. Eggs, actually 100% more expensive. And other products, those prices are going up as well. Now, they're expecting things will return to normal after the virus passes. But I thought this is just a good time to remind listeners of something we've said for years about just preparing to reduce your standard of living. Our founder, Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong, actually in the late 1970s and early 1980s, actually had two series of articles, or two articles published about 3 years apart, entitled "Prepare to Greatly Reduce Your Standard of Living," where he went through some of the economic problems of the time, but then also pointed to the much bigger picture of the prophecies in Leviticus 26 about the blessings and cursings of a nation, showing how that leads to economic collapse, devaluations of currencies, and circumstances where people need to be living at a much lower standard than they were at that time to be able to weather those types of crises and still support God's work during those types of crises. So this coronavirus could kind of be like a dress rehearsal in a way, prompting people to do just that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have an article in the coming Trumpet edition that talks about just how much all of the debt that our nations are incurring, America really at the top of the list, is going to be putting a whole lot of pressure on the currency, and it could devalue our currency substantially, even as they're giving out these checks to give short-term relief to some of these problems. The long-term problems are only going to get worse. Well, thank you very much for that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker. That's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of S.G. Goodrich. Perseverance gives power to weakness and opens to poverty the world's wealth. It spreads fertility over the barren landscape and bids the choicest flowers and fruits spring up and flourish in the desert abode of thorns and briars. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.